actually speak this morning. I feel very overwhelmed, and yeah, I knew that was going to happen, so he'll be sharing more. I just feel very honored that you would give us this time to share with you guys and to ask you to be praying for us for the next 5 months, and so that we didn't have to talk as much, we actually have a video. About 5 years ago, God led us into quite a change of life with John's job. He had been at Concordia for quite a few years, but a whole change was when this around the world semester happened for us. And there's, I'm sure, quite a few of you in the room that know this on the back, like, really well, because you've heard us talk about it so much, but some don't. And so just the short of it was, it's a very unique opportunity, but our heart is for college students, and we get to be with 25 to 30 college students for 5 months, and it's an around-the-world semester, and John's actually the professor during it with one other professor, Adam, and teaching, and it's very much academic and studying and learning culture and travel writing, and he'll talk a little more about that, but it's all of that, and it's a hybrid because then it's also a missions trip at the same time, and so to get to be in the world and to be in these countries and not just selfishly see them for our own good, but actually dive in and come alongside people who are already pouring their heart out in those countries. We're not bringing anything new or extra talents that we may have as a group. It's more just coming alongside people who are already living in that country and giving their whole life to people. And so we get to go and be an encouragement, help, whatever. Tell us what to do and we'll do something while we're there. So it's a great honor and a privilege. And so as we go out to do this again, John is going to tell you where we're going. But we thought we would show the video, the best way to sum up what we feel like we want you to know about this next trip and about how to be praying for us is actually to watch the video from the last time we did this, 4 years ago. Some of you may have seen this, some of you I'm sure have not, but it describes the trip, it describes some of the outcomes of the trip, and that's what we would pray that you'd be praying for us on this next trip. Yeah. Does that sum it up?
Okay.
Peter?
I think one of the greatest strengths of the Around the World semester is its built-in comparative nature.
I loved how connected the academics were with where we were at. Everything was tied together.
We learned how to apply our academics to the world.
It was probably the hardest semester I think I've ever had so far.
I definitely appreciated the stretch that it required of us academically.
One of the most challenging things to improvise as professors were our classrooms.
We never knew when we were going to have a class, and we never knew where we would be having a class.
We got to have a class at a temple in Petra.
We taught in the only place that we could find next to the pyramids where there was shade.
We even studied on the plane sometimes. So we'd come by with stuff for us to read, walk down the aisles and say, okay, you gotta read this, or you're gonna have a quiz on it.
We quickly learned that the world itself was our classroom. What we study is not textbooks, but primary sources.
Like, we weren't reading a book about the Quran, we were reading the actual text. We could really get a good conversation.
While in Ankara, Turkey, we got the opportunity to meet the head imam, and we were talking about Christianity, and we were talking about the Muslim faith, and it was one of those moments where the things that I had seen on TV were shattered.
We did so much in such a short amount of time. The way I describe it is I lived 4 years in 4 months.
So you would say, oh, are you gonna go to sleep? Like, why are you gonna go to sleep? Are you gonna take a nap? You could go somewhere, you could do something that will shape you, that will, that you'll remember forever.
We would just look at each other, like, you know, like, should we do this? And be like, well, like, if we don't do it, we're not gonna get to do it again. So it's just like realizing that, like, you know, this was like your opportunity, you had to seize the opportunity sometimes when you weren't even ready.
But that's how travel was for me. Real spontaneous, I lost track of all time. I had no idea what day of the week it was.
Most of the time, I just didn't even know what was going on. It was just, okay, let's do this, because it's here and it's random.
I made a personal goal of mine to run in every single country. We were hiking up Mount Sinai. I remember thinking, this is taking forever. We ran up Sinai.
And that night we worshiped on the top of Mount Sinai. It was one of those moments where you just feel like God was like right there next to you.
We were told that we're going to this place called Cappadocia. He would not tell us what it was. And so we just got on a bus and went. You just see all these mounds all over the place with all these caves inside. I had no idea that existed.
The vice principal runs out to his car and says, wait, I want to show you something. And he brings back this small case, and I was like, what the heck is this? And he pulls out this weird looking gourd flute thing. And he was going on and on and on, and people were like, yeah, you're doing great. And it was just really bizarre.
Our last guy's night out was in China, and I took them to a typical male bonding activity, getting a little foot massage. Asked me in Chinese if I wanted my legs hot or not hot. So I said, sure, we'd love to have our feet be la. And as I looked down, my legs went up in flames immediately, and I was screaming, ah! And I turned, and one by one down the row of chairs, each of their legs just most radical experiences I've had with my leg hair around the world.
One of our greatest adventures was probably staying with homestays. They all took care of us and they made sure we had what we needed.
In Kenya, music is just everywhere. And the mentors that we worked with that worked in the slums as well, they had formed an a cappella singing men's group called the Conquerors. And oh my gosh, did they sing. Awesome songs. They taught the boys a song called Mama Africa.
Sing along, sing along, sing along, sing along for Mama.
In Jerusalem, we met a group.
Another group from California, actually, from Murrieta.
And they invited us to go to worship night on one of the nights, and we're walking through the streets of Jerusalem, and then we just plop down, like, right in the middle of the street with shops on either sides
and different restaurants and cool like walking area between walking street, and just sit down and start worshiping.
It was something so unlike anything I've ever done before. Just to be able to like close my eyes and like lift up my hands and sing right there in the middle of like Jerusalem and Israel was just, it was incredible.
It was a trip where we learned about how great God was over and over and over and over again.
The Word of God pervading through our team, through our own personal devotions, but then as our group rallied around and did devotions on a daily basis, I saw the Word of God bringing a peace and a calm to our team that I didn't expect. We discovered in a new and powerful way our dependence on the Holy Spirit, and He came through in an amazing way. I really believe the purpose behind the trip, the service missional element of the trip, forced a lot of us to really get on our knees and say, God, we need you. We can't do this on our own. We cannot muster up our own courage. We can't fabricate our own sense of spirituality in the face of this kind of desperation, in the face of this kind of poverty.
We've seen like the worst of human depravity. Like we've seen kids like who have gotten kicked out of their houses in Kenya and are on glue, and we've seen people in India who have come from the sex trade, whose like parents have put them in there, like who've been just like horribly abused. But in the midst of all that, like I have seen this undeniable hope and this undeniable beauty, like, and the people in those countries too at the same time. And I was like, that is what overtakes me about God. It's like, in the midst of all this, that is still evident.
When you think about a missions trip, you think about just going and experiencing people and loving on people and like, that's it. But we did so much more than just do that.
We had a lot of fun, like, and looking at these people now, like thinking about it, I'm thinking about like how much fun we had.
I think one of the most surprising things about the trip really was the family dynamic.
Being with 25 people is better than being by yourself. We weren't able to, I don't know, think about ourselves. And it was great.
There's no community that I've been a part of in my life that's been as tight as that we were together in this trip.
For 4 months, you get upset with people, you get happy, you struggle sometimes, and you really get to know them.
It was absolutely wonderful.
And this trip wouldn't be the same without the group, without the professors, and it's community, and that's what Jesus did with his disciples. So we experienced community for 4 months.
It's a challenge, but it's the best challenge I've ever had. And I know that my entire life is different in the best way possible because of it.
You're surrounded by positivity and pushed to be greater and to constantly have your mind focused on God or the other people around you, so you couldn't be selfish.
I really grew up, learned how to ask questions about myself, about other people.
We are not the only ones in the world, and we are very, very blessed of being where we are. And you can go and share that all around the world. And that's why we are here.
It's really amazing to see how God took me from St. Louis to Concordia, Nebraska, to Concordia, Irvine, and then to around the world and all the things that he's shown me since then.
It's not like we're going out into the world and trying to share God and introduce God to these people. No, he's already there. And, you know, like, he doesn't need us, but he's so gracious and merciful and just all-inclusive that he'll use us and use his children to reach out to others, which is really humbling.
Before the trip, I had blinders on, and I was just, like, focused on my own life and, you know, just really selfish. And then this trip basically, like, took my blinders off.
Here we are. I'm loving God, I'm loving people, serving, and I still have 4 more years at Concordia. So I'm excited and looking forward for the next Around the World trip.
I think that each little experience that we had, we're reminded of it, and it comes out every single day. You realize that the trip was real. And I think that's what we can hold on to. Like, that's what God has given us to pursue and to remind us of him all the time.
That young lady there who spoke at the end, Ellie Hansen, she ended up going on the next Around the World trip, was in 2012, and then she's going to be one of our leaders this time. So this is her third time around the world. Really great young lady with a wonderful heart and a real servant's heart. How you guys doing? It's good to be here. Last Sunday for months. I can't believe this. You know, this last week, I wasn't surprised when lots of things started going wrong around the house. The water main in front of our house blew, and there's water everywhere. The plumber came out 3 times. Somehow the first 2 times weren't good enough. Came out the 3rd time, and it was going to be $500 to fix this thing. I said, you know, there's got to be a way. And he said, well, if you do the digging around the pipe, and you cut it, and I said, okay. And he said, yeah, it'll just be $200 then. I could do some digging for $300. Yeah, no problem. There's a problem there. Not a great digger. So I got my boy out there, and we're digging out this thing. This huge hole, you know, and had to expose the pipe, and finally we got it done, and the guy came back out and fixed the pipe. And then he said at the end, this kind of stuck with me. And this morning, actually, I feel like God was kind of showing me something through this process. So he said, so when you put the dirt back in, you got to make sure that you pack it in. You pack it in below the pipe. So the pipe has support, because there's a lot of, you know, over 100 pounds of pressure coming through this pipe. You want to make sure you pack the dirt in. Because the pipe is done well, it's glued properly, but you want to make sure there is earth tightly packed around the pipe for support. I said, okay, I got this. So I, you know, Jack and I did carefully. He was the whole time, I love mud, you know, just jamming mud in there. Got to have the positive guy next to me. It really helps when you're doing manual labor. And so just this morning, I started thinking about that, and I feel like the Holy Spirit said, you know, that is really the adventure you're on. You've been packed tightly in community, and it's a wonderful thing, and I feel like I've grown, and I've been so supported by this community. It's really amazing. And now, in a very amazing way, and I suppose in a daunting way, and that we've done this once before, but I know what to expect now. I know that the community will be kind of carved out around us. I know that we will be exposed like that pipe. And I do trust, and I know for a fact that God's Holy Spirit never leaves us exposed. But The mystery of community is something that I've grown to love and depend upon. I don't understand all that is wrapped up in community and how God has blessed it, but I do know that it's vital in my life. And I know that we depend upon each other in some mysterious ways. Community is not just a group of best buddies who you can go to the movies with all the time and go out and have dinners. That's not really all of community. Sometimes that happens. That's really nice. Community is something far deeper than that. The community is the people you call when your child is sick in the hospital. Community is someone and people you depend upon when you have deep needs and you know they're going to pray for you. As simple as it sounds, community is a large part of the prayer chain. Community is a large part of what happens here on Sundays when we find a little bit more about each other and we enter into each other's struggles. Sometimes from a distance, but sometimes very close as well. So, with my pipe metaphor there, we won't have your support in the same way we have it on a regular basis. We will be an exposed pipe. And yet, this is Erica whispered to me before I came up, make sure you remind them about how they can be praying for us. I feel that, you know, as we're gone, I felt this last time, that your prayers really became that earth that packed in around us. There were times when we were talking along the trip, on this first trip, where I said, I really feel like we're being prayed for. For the first time in my life, I really felt in a powerful way prayers from a distant land, home, in Egypt, or in Jordan, or in Israel, or in Africa, or in India, or Bali, where all the different places we were. I felt your prayers being packed in around us like strong earth and mud around that pipe supporting it. So that's my request. I'm starting with a request. Is that okay? So, this trip here, we're excited to go. I do feel like being an exposed pipe definitely makes us appreciate what we have here. I think oftentimes when you go away, you realize what you have and how vital it is in your life. And I think we're going to come back in December with even more appreciation, perhaps with new eyes. I remember that's how it was in 2010. I came back with new eyes, a new love, a new appreciation for Kevin as our pastor, but you as our community as well. So this trip, we start in Rio. This Friday, as you guys are doing your carnival, we'll be nearly landing in Rio de Janeiro. We'll start there, and then we'll move into a town called Curitiba, south of Rio. And we're working with really wonderful missionaries there, the Abel family. They've been there for over 20 years. We'll be working with a lot of the youth in Brazil, doing after-school English camps. And they set up these English camps as a way to evangelize, a way to share the gospel with the community. So we'll be able to come alongside this community of missionaries there in Curitiba. We fly to Paraguay from there. In Paraguay, we work with a missionary group there, Su Refugio, Scott Gvandoval. I can't really pronounce his name. Scott is what I'll be calling him when I'm there. Scott had a vision from God several years ago, about 16 years ago, to start a camp in Paraguay. Paraguay, the population, the male population in Paraguay was ravaged by a triple alliance war. It took place in the 70s, I believe it was, and a third of the male population was killed. A third of the male population in Paraguay. If you can imagine what that does to the family structure over a course of a generation, there are no fathers, there are no uncles, there are no brothers. There's a large gap in that structure, in that vital foundational structure in a community. And so this man, Scott, saw that. God really led him to say, we need to make sure we're encouraging and drawing together strong men, training them to really be an encouragement in the community as well. From there, we fly to South Africa. We're working with a black pastor in South Africa who was part of the Lutheran Church all the way through apartheid and the ravages of apartheid, the horrific ravaging effects of apartheid in South Africa. He was a man who had a black and white congregation in apartheid South Africa, spent a lot of time in jail. Because of that, that was illegal for him to do that. This is a man who weathered the storm of apartheid and now has wonderful stories and is teaching, actually, the Lutheran Church and many churches worldwide about what it means to look beyond color and how to integrate both black and white and other cultures into a church setting. I can't wait to be learning to learn from this man. From there, we fly to Istanbul, Turkey. We're working with Syrian refugees in Turkey and obviously with especially the current climate, there is quite a large population of Syrian refugees in Turkey. So prayer, sorry, I missed the prayer part. Brazil, praying for our impact with youth. Paraguay with the men. South Africa with this pastor to learn and draw from him. In Turkey, the community in Turkey, I've learned, is not thrilled about the Syrian refugee camps. And I can understand that from a certain aspect as well. That is not a beautiful thing to have refugee camps in your country. And yet, the Turkish government has been very generous. And so that's going to be interesting to navigate those waters as we want to minister both to Turkish as well as Syrian. And not a welcome population in Turkey, which is going to be tense, I think. From there, we go up to Romania. There's a population in Romania. People call them gypsies, but that is actually a derogatory term for a community called Romani. It's a very ancient community of traveling folks who don't really have a nation, but they are very much on the fringes of society. A large part of the sex trafficking community is drawn and stolen from this Romani community that are really kind of on the edge and not really well protected. And so we're working with Romanis, the Romani community there, doing camps, doing VBS-style ministry there with them, which would be fun. After 10 years of training here, we're taking that on the road a little bit, which would be great. After Romania, we fly to Nepal. We're in Kathmandu, this capital city, for a little while, a couple days. Then when we take a long bus ride, about 18 hours, there's some prayer. he'll be two by then. Little Sheffield will turn two in Paraguay. Little Sheffield on an 18-hour bus ride, I will need some serious dirt packing support for that one. We'll stop about 9 hours in and have a rest and perhaps a night, and then on for another 9 hours to this awesome village. This Argentine woman and an American man met in seminary and felt God called them to Nepal. And they're ministering in Nepal in this remote village out really at the foothills of of Everest in that whole Himalayan area. This village has just been opened to the gospel. And the school there is excited about a group of Americans coming to teach about the Bible, as well as the church. And so that's going to be very exciting. They say, just be ready for this, you know, hundreds of children to run and mob rush your bus. And so I think that'll be very fun and exciting to be in Nepal and to be able to encourage that mission work from a large group standpoint. The missionaries were thrilled because there is so much work, and we're going to bring about 40 people into that camp, into that community. And they say it will be a great time to really kind of to boost the preaching of the gospel and the teaching of the gospel in that Nepali village. From there, we fly down to Kolkata, India, which I have a deep and wonderful heart for now after I went in 2012. I love Calcutta. I am mesmerized and inspired by Mother Teresa's legacy there, an incredible place, where I can't wait to have Erica come and see what I experienced this last 2 years ago, entering into the suffering, being invited into suffering of men and women, and being able to work in really a hospice situation there with bathing people who are on the verge of death, bringing tea out to people who have suffered the ravages of disease. We'll go to a leper colony. We'll be able to see and work with the lepers there at Mother Teresa's leper colony. This will be soul-changing for us once again, I believe. And so, again, your prayers in regards to just having our hearts open. I felt like a walnut last time. I think I described last time when I went in there. I felt like maybe this isn't quite right for me, this hospice-style ministry. I have a PhD in Shakespearean literature and drama. I am sure there's some pulpit somewhere where I could speak from and some lesson I could give on how to analyze Shakespearean drama. I don't think bathing this naked man here is really what I went to education to get my school for. Fool that I am. The Lord opened up my eyes a few days in, thankfully. I didn't waste too much time in that idiocy. Soon I was realizing and knowing that this is what God has called us into. And this is an invitation that you won't always get in this life, to enter into someone else's suffering. And so that would be a great prayer to again, help us have that strength to enter into the suffering. After India, excuse me, we go to Thailand. For Thailand is our week of worship and debriefing. We have a week there on the beach. It'll be very nice in Koh Tao. Just a time to rest and to reflect and to prepare for the next leg, which will be to Cambodia. And Cambodia, I think very similarly to India, is a community that's been ravaged by war, by disease, obviously with Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, devastating. A third of the whole population was emptied out. All of Phnom Penh was emptied out. Again, a third of the population killed by Pol Pot in the 70s. Terrifying genocide that he kind of enacted, and the country is still reeling from that, obviously, from the 70s. Just a short while ago, the country still feels the ravages of this horrific man and his regime. Ironically, the group we're working with there is a guy named Christopher Lapel, amazing, heroic man, another great heroic man. His family actually was killed by the Khmer Rouge. He fled to America by a series of other countries as a teenager, and now God has led him to establish a ministry in a city called Battambang, which is west of Phnom Penh, focusing on ministering to the Khmer Rouge. And many of the families of those who killed his own families are the ones he is taking the gospel to. And so we get to walk with this man, Christopher Lapel, and I just can't wait to know him and to learn from him. He has a church in Long Beach, actually, and he is in Cambodia several times a year building this ministry called Hope Cambodia. And so we'll be working with the Khmer Rouge, whom he is saying now is far more open to the gospel than ever before. And so we're very excited about that opportunity, too. Discernment, I suppose, in prayer as we work with the Cambodians, I think would be key. I think that really is apropos for everywhere we go. As we communicate via sign language and translator, which usually go hand in hand, there's often a language you can speak that is not always verbal. And we pray for God's strength in that and God's discernment, how to communicate and how to communicate well. After Cambodia, our last stop is South Korea. I gave all the final exams in South Korea, which is really fun for me. The students have a different feel about the final exams, but they'll be well-prepared. And so we'll be in South Korea. We'll start in Incheon and then head up to a prayer mountain where we'll do our debriefing, our final exams, and just get ready for our trip home. So the trip, that right there is the missional element of the trip. In every country as well, Erica warned me not to bore you with the details of every last book we read. The video, I think, kind of displayed some of that. We read the Quran as we travel through Muslim nations. This is an awesome thing to do because we get to talk with that imam. His name was Ishmael Kosar. Actually, I'm a Facebook friend with him still today. An amazing guy led us through his massive Kocha Tepe Mosque, one of the biggest mosques in that part of the world. He cried when he held Jack's face, looked into his eyes. He says, "I see God in this boy's eyes." And he started weeping. It was incredible. So we read the Quran. When he heard we read the Quran, it made him well up with tears, saying, why would you powerful Americans care to read our little book? And we explained, we want to know, we want to understand your lives and what's important to you so that we can share what's important to us. And so right there in his mosque, I shared the gospel with this imam, which was an awesome opportunity. Pretty sweet. So we read books, sacred texts. That's part of how our literature sections are broken up. Ancient literature. We read all the most important ancient literature. I shouldn't say the most important. We read very important ancient literature from the Quran to the Bhagavad Gita through Hindu countries, Upanishads. We read the ancient Chinese texts. We read folk tales, ancient folk tales from South America and Africa, tales that have really shaped the culture. The second part of the literature class is called postmodern literature. We read the newest stuff coming out that really reflects the most modern contemporary tensions. The last time we were in Turkey, we read a book called Snow, and Snow was all about the new generation of women coming up who wanted to wear or felt pressured to wear headscarves. They felt like that was right for them. The older generation of Turkish women said, this is going backward. We don't want to go back to this tribal beliefs of old Islam. And the Turkish are very proactive or progressive like this. It's a very interesting culture. But this younger generation wanted to wear the headscarves. And it was causing quite a stir. It was a very real thing as we entered Turkey and really started talking with and making friends there in Turkey. And so that's the postmodern class. It really deals with a lot of the really more prominent issues. The text we're reading in South America is about drugs and the drug trade. It's about leveling of forests in Brazil and Paraguay as well. So ancient text, modern text, we coach the students through and we learn ourselves as we go six different languages. So we have six different languages. By the end of the final exam, it's a pretty awesome moment where Adam and I, the other professor, you saw him in the video, the first one there, great guy. He and I sit at a desk. Two students come in. We say, go ahead, have a conversation in Spanish. So they have about a 3-minute conversation in Spanish. Portuguese, go. Same conversation in Portuguese. Zulu, go. Conversation in Zulu. Turkish, go. Conversation in Turkish. Nepalese, boom, go. Conversation in Nepalese. Hindi, go. Conversation in Hindi. Korean, go. It should be Khmer. It's Khmer Rouge, Khmer language. Khmer, go. And they have a conversation. So it's fantastic. I got chills last time. We went through these 6 languages, and they just belted them out. It was incredible. And most all of them just nailed it because they just study the whole time. They make friends. They have they want to know the language because they want to be able to communicate it. So we have a phrase book they have to memorize, but they go well beyond that every single time because they want to communicate to the children they're falling in love with, to the friends they're making, to the heroes that we're meeting that we want to know more about. How do you have the courage to go into brothels and take women out of slavery? That was last time we were in India. We met a guy who did that and had been thrown in jail several times because of that kind of anti-slavery work. This time, I imagine, we'll be compelled to ask Christopher LaPelle, what brings you back to a place who killed and to a group that killed your own family? How do you have the courage to do that? Right? So they're compelled to want to know these languages. And so that's a really neat part of our classes. That's the third one, language. We do a travel writing class where they're learning to write as they go. It's a basic writing class that I teach at Concordia, but we customize it for the trip. How do you write about culture without sounding cliche? Right? Africans have beautiful smiles. Yeah, you don't put that in there. That's just, first of all, it's kind of stereotypical and it's just cliche. What is something important about someone you meet them? It's not the color of their skin. What is important about how they express themselves in their culture? And so we try to get below the surface of what it is to actually interact culturally, not from a ethnocentric Americans rule kind of perspective, which is very harmful, dealing with anybody outside, a very small clique of white Americans. And so we train these folks to really get outside of their whiteness, which is difficult, very difficult, because there's a lot of ethnocentrism that's woven into us, I think, by the water we drink. And so that's part of our travel writing. How do you interact? How do you communicate properly and well and clearly about culture? And lastly, the fifth class is called service learning. And we spend the first 2 to 3 hours of every day doing book classes. The latter part of every day, about 3 hours, we spend in some kind of service with these groups, right? That's kind of how we organize our day. First time we went, we didn't have this class, but we thought, you know, as we're serving, we want to make sure the students are thinking about what service is, and so we're reading books that are really interesting about nonprofit organizations, about community development, and so we're reading a book, several books about this. One of them is Serving with Eyes Wide Open. Another text called When Helping Hurts. And other texts like this. Radical is one of our books as well. Just about serving. Friendship at the margins. I actually preached about that several weeks ago. What does it mean to serve? What does it mean to come in as a rich American? And I've never felt so wealthy as I did, or as I have, as walking through slums of India and Calcutta, walking through parts of Mumbai. I've never felt so grossly wealthy. You may become very self-conscious of your wealth when you're in these extremely poor situations where almost want to look down and say, oof, can I take something off to not to appear quite so grossly wealthy? And again, it's one of those getting out of your own culture that makes you kind of look this way, I suppose, and think this way. So how do we help without hurting? How do we enter in to learn from people who are really courageous without getting in their way? How do we begin to interpret what service is in a healthy way? Not just throwing money, but really entering in. And so we wrestle with these ideas. And it's a great class where we begin to have these difficult conversations with students. Well, that's the academic portion. And so I think I'm almost at the end of my time here. But the last thing I was going to mention, and Erica kind of mentioned it, she coined this the other day, said, I really feel like we're missionaries to college students. And I like that a lot. I feel like this has been my work for a long time. This trip brought her in and my family, Jack, Naomi, and now Sheffield, will be a part of the ministry that God has called me into in education, working with college students. Missionaries to college students, I like that. We have been praying for new ways to walk closely with college students, and God brought this trip along, and I felt like this is an incredible way to walk closely with college students. I wrote this down. The trip has served as a new and wonderful way to involve our family in college ministry. The ministry to these students begins before the trip in the planning stages with like prep classes, but also with dinners at our house, events on campus, and so forth. The ministry gets intense, obviously, when we begin to walk through uncomfortable places and are pushed in uncomfortable ways to think about ourselves and our culture that we hadn't thought about before, and we're walking with students through this discomfort. It's a great way to get close to someone, and so this is a great part of the ministry, I think. And then the ministry continues after the trip as our lives are connected in some wonderful, significant ways. These become our friends. These students become our friends, our dear friends. By serving each other, we forge bonds of friendship that last. The work has inspired me to think differently about evangelism and ministry. There is something powerful about serving alongside others, about entering into friendship and giving yourself to others in friendship. I think that's it.